I'd like to thank you all for coming, and welcome to our Hot Docs Talks, What Makes It Political? This is the first in a series of three filmmaker discussions. So before I get started, I just want to take a minute to thank our sponsor, the Canadian Television Fund, and also please be aware that Centennial College's Creative Communications Department is actually recording this and podcasting it. So if you want to tap into that later, you can just visit the Centennial College website, and it'll navigate you to Hot Docs Talks. So with that, I'm very pleased to welcome our moderator of this afternoon's panel, documentary programmer at Toronto International Film Festival, Mr. Tom Powers.
Thank you. Welcome to Hot Docs and such a wonderful smorgasbord of documentary viewing. Before I introduce our panelists, I just want to kind of open up a context for thinking about political documentaries. Movies have been used for political purposes probably as long as they have been movies. I think of Gore Vidal's novel, Hollywood, about films in the 10s and the 20s and the political purposes were being put used to in a fiction way. I think when it comes to documentaries, there have always been political uses of documentaries. We think of Frank Capra's series during World War II, Why We Fight, title later appropriated by Eugene Jarecki for his film. And if you think of a film like Good Night and Good Luck, which the film directed by George Clooney that looks at the way Edward Murrow in the 1950s was shifting a political culture through not quite what we think of documentaries today, but certainly a kind of documentary style set of interviewing and examining a subject. In the 1960s, you saw a rise of independent documentarians like Emile D'Antonio, whose first film took that footage of McCarthy that's also brought up with Edward Murrow, made a film out of it called Point of Order. You see the emergence of a filmmaker like Marcello Fools in his film Sorrow and the Pity, which was the first film 25 years after World War II that broke the bad news to France that they weren't all resistance fighters. And Sorrow and the Pity, it's a four-hour, you know, very meaty epic of a documentary film. It's 4 hours of talking heads virtually, and yet it still played in a New York theater for 18 months, so that if you may remember it in Annie Hall, that Woody Allen is dragging Diane Keaton off to see Sorrow and the Pity at the beginning of their relationship, and then at the end of their relationship it's still playing in theaters, and they're still going to see it. So today there's an undeniable rise in the sense of political documentary, but it has roots. It's not a brand new thing out of nowhere. Certainly the boom time that we've seen recently, I think, kind of emerged in 2003, 2004, particularly around the U.S. presidential election, where you had a range of films, including a lot of kind of agitprop films. And something else we've seen in the last 5 to 10 years is the emergence of this digital technology, which has made it much easier for independent filmmakers to take a digital video camera and go out and report a story themselves in a way that they were previously just prohibited by the cost of technology and economics. And so we have a lot of that kind of independent spirit represented on this panel today. I'm going to start at my far right. What I'll do here is I'm going to introduce the panelists one by one. I'll introduce them. We'll hear a bit about their film. We'll watch a brief clip of their film, and then I'll go on to the next person, and then we'll begin the proper discussion. And I sort of like the way this is configured, almost like a wrestling match. So if we do have to, you know, strip down and make this more physical, we've got the right situation. So On the far end, Ricky Stern is the co-director with Annie Sundberg of The Devil Came on Horseback. It's a documentary about Darfur that had its world premiere at the Sundance Film Festival. And I will let Ricky give you a further description of it.
I just wanted to acknowledge one of our producers who's here. But where'd she go? Jane? Oh, Jane Wells. Just stand up because people may want to ask you questions afterwards. And this was definitely a team effort, this film. The film is about Brian Steidel, who is an ex-U.S. Marine captain, young man at the time of making this film, 27 years old. And it's really his journey into Darfur as a African Union peace monitor and his documentation of the genocide he witnessed. And he came back with the photographs. And that's where we began to tell our story through his photographs. And then the film goes on to follow him on his, upon his return to, in his journey to have the photographs seen by the State Department and to get attention to what's happening in Darfur. And it shows how his frustration and despite sort of the grassroots movement that's started, and he was one of the individuals to sort of propel the action, it's, as we all know, politically, things really haven't changed in Darfur.
So if the projectionist is ready, we will show a little clip of that.
In 2004, I became an unarmed military observer with the African Union in Darfur, Sudan. All I had was a camera, a pen, and a paper. I was totally unprepared for what I'd see.
Our next guest sitting next to Ricky is Ayelet Heller from Israel. Her film is called Strawberry Fields, which is going to be playing later today, right? Will has its first premiere. And I should say Devil Came on Horseback.
It's playing at 2:30 right after
playing
this.
Playing at 2:30 right after
the
this.
So, I have tickets. If anyone
see it when it comes out in the theater. Strawberry Fields looks at a group of Palestinians, farmers in Gaza growing strawberries. And, I will let finish that description.
Okay. So the film is about strawberries, but it's really about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it's about hope. I hope it's about hope. But it's about strawberries grown in Gaza that are exported to Europe for Christmas and the winter. So it's very highly, it's a very good strawberry. The plants are grown in Israel and brought, the farmers, they buy the plants from Israel, they grow the strawberries, and then they have to bring the strawberries to Israel, and Israel exports the strawberries. But the problem is that Gaza is like the, it's like a big jail. It has two passes, two crossings, one for people and one for goods. And the crossing are of course controlled by Israel. And if they decide to close the crossing, the strawberries and everything stays in Gaza and nothing goes in and out. So that's one problem, the crossings. And the second problem is the the shooters of the Qassam, the rockets towards Israel, are shot from. They use the fields for that's the location of the shooting. So, Israeli army bombs back this area. So sometimes it's also bombs the strawberries, although Israel has. They want the farmers to grow strawberries because then they get money, and you know it's very complicated situation. And I hoped that in this year that I documented the strawberries, it was a full agricultural cycle. It will be a good year because it was the year of the disengagement. And but things changed. The Hamas came out. Won the elections, and everything became really. Really bad, but this year it was better.
So we will look at a clip of strawberry fields.
شغلتنا الزراعة التوت مش أكتر يعني إن 30 سنة أو 40 سنة أبواتنا اشتغلوا في هالشغلة وخلفوا أولادهم وأولادهم بيشتغلوا في التوت مش أكتر. مش عارفين نشتغل بالمرة الواحد بيشتغل وخايف انت شايف قاعد بطلع هيك دقيقة عليك ودقيقة على الجراف يا ساتر يا ربي علي وعلى بختي ورايا اولادهم ورايا مرة وخلي ايش بدي اسوي بدنا نبني لهم مستقبل نعلمهم في التوب الواحد
just the way we do our gardening.
If you didn't understand, the tanks were Israeli, and I mean, it was the other side was Israel, and the strawberries was Gaza.
Okay, our third panelist is Kurt Johnson with the provocatively titled film, Your Mommy Kills Animals. That's not all she does. She eats them and wears them, too. Kurt, can you give us a description of your film?
It's an in-depth look at the animal rights movement and how in the United States the FBI has declared them the number one domestic terrorist threat to that country.
So if the projection booth is ready, we will have a look at Your Mommy Kills Animals.
A lot of people who are attracted to this movement are younger people, and they don't have a full grasp on tactics and strategies. And we have to understand that when you're pushing what's considered by the establishment to be a radical agenda, I mean, what's a radical agenda? Not killing animals to eat them is a radical agenda in our country. You have to understand that you're going up against some very violent opposition.
He's got a shotgun.
Yeah. A shotgun.
Who will not hesitate to destroy your life. So people should be fully aware of that and know what they're getting into. And unfortunately, a lot of people, I think, they go into these things without a full realization of what the consequences are for their actions. And then when they're arrested, they're actually shocked.
Does it work what they do? I don't know. Maybe it all works, and maybe none of it works. And all I can do is say, look at the kill rates at our shelters, and they're going down. And maybe something's working. Something's working.
And we should say, Your Mommy Kills Animals premieres tomorrow.
Night at 9:15 at the Bloor.
And our last panelist is Rick Kane, who is the co-director with Debbie Melnick of Manufacturing Dissent, a film about Michael Moore and his films. And do you want to finish that description, Rick?
I think that's pretty accurate. That's what it is. It's a film about Michael Moore and his films. And what that means for documentary filmmaking and audiences more broadly speaking. So we have a clip from this too. We have been following Michael Moore in the Slacker Uprising Tour, which was his Michael believes, and he's right about this, that if young people were more involved in the political process, we'd have much more progressive politics, not only in Canada, but certainly in the United States and many other countries. And if you look at the voting rate, seniors vote at roughly twice the rate that young people do. So Michael had organized a Slacker Uprising tour where he visited 60 universities in 20 swing states in the lead up to the 2004 election. And initially, his people were quite thrilled to have us following Michael around, but then things started to get ugly from there, and we have a clip.
So if the projection booth is ready, it's a clip from Manufacturing Dissent.
Suddenly, Michael's publicist and security arrive and kick me and my cameraman out. I guess he was more aware of our film than he let on earlier. Anne Moore, Michael's sister, forces our camera to the ground, but it isn't turned off.
Who are you with?
City TV.
You have false credentials. You got it.
You broke my camera.
Oh, bullshit.
She starts to interrogate me.
Let me have your credentials. See this sign?
Right.
Do you have permission to film for commercial purposes?
Documentaries aren't
considered. Did you see the sign?
No, I didn't see the sign.
Okay. There is no filming that is allowed here without permission because there's no commercial ventures. We allow people to film who are part of the affiliates or part of free TV, but not for commercial purposes such as yours.
But news media such as ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, CNN are a lot more commercial oriented, you know, than documentaries.
I want to know who your supervisor is. I'll call right now. Give me her cell phone number.
Stop grabbing my camera.
Can you just escort these people out of here? We'll keep your ID and mail it back to you.
No, you're not going to be keeping my ID. Sorry, you're not keeping my ID. That's bullshit.
Filming for commercial purposes.
Please film it right now. You need to stop it.
Yeah, you need to turn
down.
So we're being banned.
So you need to leave the building.
We're being banned from a Michael Moore speech, who is for free speech.
Thank you.
Let's go.
So what I think is fascinating about this group of panelists for the for our topic of political documentaries is each one is approaching the filmmaking in a slightly different way, and I want to start there, and we'll go back to Ricky. When you set out to take on this project, did you start with your character? Did you start with wanting to do something about Darfur? How did you approach it?
Yeah, in the case of this film, we had met Brian's sister, and she had told us that she had a brother who was in Darfur who was taking these photographs. We just casually said, if he comes back with these photographs, we'd really like to have an opportunity to expose them and to make a film about his photographs. And so it was in the character first, and it was important. As much as my film partner was interested in doing a film about Africa, and so immediately, you know, we jumped on it. But I think for us, it was very important to find a character who could compel an audience to sit through a film about genocide. Because, you know, we all know that there's no point in making a movie if no one is going to see it. So there had to be something about the person telling the story that was more than just an advocate or an advocacy film or an industrial approach to telling a political story.
And I think it's, having seen all the films by the makers on this panel, I think I can endorse each and every one of them as bringing on a very lively approach to sometimes difficult subjects. In the case of Ailette, I've seen many, many documentaries as a programmer about the conflict in the Middle East. There's, in fact, another very good one here at Hot Docs called Nine Star Hotel. Ailette, in taking on another film about the conflict in Israel-Palestine, how did you arrive at your subject, and how did you deal with the fact that there are so many other films, you know, around this subject?
Well, I didn't That was not a question for me about other films, you know. It's just I thought this story is very dramatic, and it's like a metaphor. It's not the thing itself, you know. It's not like the conflict, where you see films about Palestinians that suffer. I don't say those Palestinians don't suffer, but it's a different way. I tried to find a little bit optimistic. Optimistic point of view, as you know, in the end they start all over. But I thought it was something completely different. It's not similar to any other film that I saw about this conflict. It's about just farmers that, you know, grow strawberries. It's very innocent and very nice and beautiful. And I like to make films that are metaphors, that are not the thing itself, but something that you can feel more close to it, feel more related to it, because in Israel, a lot of people, they don't like to see film about the conflict. It's very hard for them to bear it, to see, and they feel very... But I think when they saw this film, a lot of people told me that they thought they are going to see annoying left film, and they enjoyed every minute. And that's what important to me, that people can see the film and it can affect them, so.
Very good. Kurt, and since there's a Michael Moore theme here, we might add that Kurt produced a previous film called Michael Moore Hates America. So one of my jobs as moderator of a documentary or of a panel about politics is to not let Michael Moore completely hijack this conversation. Your Mommy Kills Animals, you're taking a very volatile subject and really trying to talk to both sides. When you came to the subject, were you coming to it with a point of view about animal rights?
I actually knew nothing. I saw on the Drudge Report a story about how the FBI had declared, and I thought that was kind of odd, because I was like, the bunny huggers? That's all I could think. And so I'd asked a couple friends, and like liberal friends, I was like, well, what do you know about animal rights activists? And they would be like, oh, they're crazy, or they're wacko. And it was just kind of weird, because I never would have thought of them. I mean, all I ever knew was like PETA and those cool, like crazy campaigns they did. So it was just kind of like, I started from there, and I just didn't realize how big the movement was. And I just kind of, I know I watched every film that I could on it, and it always seemed to be just like you had said, there was always one side or the other, and no one had done it from just going down the middle where my opinion's not in it. And if I had known what we were going to get into, I think I would have thought twice before starting the film. But we got to talk to mink farmers and people who'd been affected by animal rights activists. But then we also followed the Shack 7, which were on trial, you know, for their website. And it was like a landmark case in the United States. So I didn't go in with any viewpoint. And I never educate myself too much on a subject, because I'm just afraid then if I know too much, I'll start to have an agenda when it comes time to edit. And I like to just be, make sure that it's as balanced as it can be. That's it.
Rick, in your case, can you talk about the evolution of getting into your film?
Well, we had just finished a film about Conrad Black, and we weren't fans of his, so we put together a list of names of potential people we thought would make for interesting biographies, and Michael was one of a number of names on the list. But as we discussed the list and whittled it down, his name did kind of rise to the top of our list. We wanted to try and do something we had never done before, which was make a laudatory or celebratory documentary. So that was our original concept for the film. We just thought, well, we'll do a straight biography. We know Michael's a big fan of Canada. His films do incredibly well here. I think 25% of the North American box office is comprised of Canadians. And a typical Hollywood release, it's usually about 10%. And we know that he's sympathetic to Canada. We knew that he liked the TV station we were working for, blah, blah, blah. So we just thought, well, we'll do a couple of interviews with them. This will be easy, yeah. That's what we thought.
And then what happened along the way?
Well, I mean, one of the things that we really like about nonfiction filmmaking is that it can be whatever the filmmaker wants it to be. It's a very malleable form. And so as we were doing what we regard as kind of a straight biography about Michael Moore, we felt the sand shifting under our feet, and we thought that we ought to follow that a little bit. We literally got to a juncture we felt like, for us, it was really kind of simple. We started, once we were sort of armed with more information than what we had gone into the film with, we started saying to ourselves openly, like, wow, are we nonfiction filmmakers and are we just going to try to stay with sort of the official version of what Michael Moore is? Or are we going to try to go this other direction that would really started to feel for us more like the truth? And so for us, it was a real simple thought. At some juncture, we just started saying to ourselves openly, well, we think documentaries should expose lies and not tell them. So there's an interesting idea there. Let's work with that.
I want to ask the panelists in general, that when people talk about political documentaries, there's a the question arises, like, what is this documentary trying to do? Is this documentary trying to change audiences? And can documentaries change audiences? And I'm willing to let anyone who wants to grab this run with it. That means you, Ricky.
We wanted to just raise awareness of what's happening in Darfur with the film. And that's really what we really, that's what Brian's agenda is, to raise awareness, to let people know with these incredible photographs and footage that is not all over the news, that is not in the New York Times, that there's murder going on every day and babies are getting killed and women are getting killed and raped and men are getting castrated and it's violent and it's happening every day. And that was just Brian's goal through his eyes was our goal with the film, just really to simply raise awareness. And then often people and take it to the next step themselves, that they want to act and they want to do something to contribute to either educating others or contribute to moving us politically towards a solution.
First, I think a documentary is a platform for conversation. I mean, much more than anything else. I don't believe it's changing, I mean, as a mass, like if, like 600 people see it and they change. No, changes, first it raises awareness, and second, one or two people, I feel that in my films, sometimes people come to me and they say, oh, this film changed my life. So it happens to one or two, and I'm happy about it. I mean, I think it's nice if I do it for one or two people, or 20 people, I don't know. So, but I think the most important is the conversation, the platform for conversation, because in a documentary, especially if you do if you stay a long time in a place, like pictures don't lie, and you know it's really strong, and that's what I think.
That's cool. But I mean, what you were saying about like if you go into a film, if you're like thinking if it's going to be political, I know like on the Mike Moore Hates America, I think until I'm 60, I'll be labeled a neocon. Everyone decided I was like a conservative because working on that film. But on this one, like on Your Mommy, I was just, it was my own curiosity. It was like, well, what makes them above Al-Qaeda? And that was basically it. And it was just kind of cool, like going to talk to people who disagree with me, because I learned more. And that's what, like you were saying with documentaries, I love to go see ones that kind of give a viewpoint I'm not used to, because I'm going to, you know, you learn a lot more than like, especially in LA, you know, a lot of times they surround themselves with everyone who believes in what they do. So you're never learning. And I just like, you know, to me it's kind of cool, like to let both sides talk evenly. And I guess that's what makes it kind of more political, because when you end up having both sides debating on screen.
What are some, any of us who have been in an edit room know that you can, you know, selectively choose someone's interview to make them look like a very eloquent person or a complete asshole. And I wonder for any of you, as you made those kind of edit room decisions, how you balance that when you're dealing with people, and perhaps your film is the best example, because there are so many people in that film who have such strongly held opinions, and you can, you know, as I say, you could edit them to make them sound reasonable or very unreasonable.
Well, I think it's almost like you become a bit of a sociopath in edit, or you have to keep your objectivity. You know, it's like to go in, because some of the people I just not care for at all. And I was at one point we were filming one of the Shaq kids, because I like most of them, but one of them just had pissed me off so much. I was like, he should be so glad I'm not going into edit this weekend. You know? But it's kind of like you just set it aside, and you almost are like just trying to tell your story, because we had so much footage. Like Tippi Hedren ended up on the cutting room floor. Amazing. And you just are trying to like tell your story, and what's the best way to tell your story? You know, it's keeping you in check, because working on the Michael Moore Hates America thing was a good test of like making sure that we're not, you know, again, God bless if he's getting messages out, but it's like just try not to use tactics to make people look bad at their expense. You know, we have a lot of humor in the film, and it's natural. It's not making fun of people, you know. So, I mean, I don't know. How was it for you, Annette?
Well, I think there is a way to do that. We try to, when we're editing, we try to apply the do unto others rule, which is if we gave an interview to another camera crew and we have 95% positive things to say about that subject, and then they choose to use the 5% negative stuff we've said, and they paint us out as a critic when we're really a supporter, we think that's wrong. So we just think how the material's handled has everything to do with it.
All of you are working independently, as far as I know. You're not working as like part of a larger news organization, or and where a lot of we're traditionally a lot of politically oriented sort of investigative news reports have come out of, because you know, until 10 or 15 years ago, they were really the only ones who had the resources to do that. And so you think of a show like the U.S.'s 60 Minutes that has a style book and a way of going about things and an approach that's evolved over many decades about, you know, balance and things like that. And you, as independent filmmakers, are more or less kind of making that up on your own as you go along. You're not working out of a, you're not answering to a larger organization.
But nor are we working in a moral vacuum either. I mean, we can't help but do sort of what our heart tells us to do, what's right, what's wrong, and all that. You guys want to talk about some of the stuff you've done?
Well, I wanted to know what your question was, because I have something to say about 60 Minutes.
Well, whip it out. But the what I was working towards a question is wondering where your sort of training came from in approaching these kind of controversial subjects.
Well, the thing I'll just say, I have a personal experience with 60 Minutes and another film that I made last year called The Trials of Daryl Hunt. 60 Minutes called me. They wanted to do a piece about the guy who I spent 10 years filming on and off and 13 years working on this movie. And long story short is HBO had bought the film, and we finally, HBO allowed our person to do a four-minute interview. And I have so much affection for Daryl Hunt, and he was a man who was wrongly imprisoned of a murder, rape murder. It was a very racially provocative case. And I was really scared that 60 Minutes, because I actually think, I don't think that they're unbiased. I think they go in with an agenda, and it's probative, and they may have both sides, but they're not necessarily honest about the story they're telling. As we've all seen on 60 Minutes, what makes it so provocative is the guy sitting there going, oh, you're going to ask me about that. Now, of course, those questions are important questions. We as an audience, oftentimes they ask these important questions. But the difference between a documentary filmmaker and what 60 Minutes does, I feel personally, is I feel an affection for my subjects, and I feel a sense of responsibility to both sides and respect for both sides. I may not agree with them, but I respect them. I appreciate people giving me time to do an interview with me, even if I don't agree with their agenda. And I wouldn't, as you say, do unto others. And I think that's the difference, that our film was, could have been a 60 Minutes, you know, many years in the process, but I also don't think we would have told, you know, wouldn't have sort of enveloped, you know, people wouldn't really understand the criminal justice system the way you can tell it as a documentary filmmaker, where you can live with the people and gain their trust and things come out. So that's my 60 Minutes rant.
Yeah, it's, the difference is the time you spend with the 60 Minutes is like a few days of...
And they have an agenda,
yeah,
you know.
Sure.
Ailette, how long time did you spend making your film?
Oh, mine was really short, but it was the fastest thing I ever done. Really, I had the idea, I got the money, and I did it. And because of the, because it's a chronologically film. It has to start when the plants come from Israel, and it has to end when start shipping to Europe. So, you know, there's no way I can play. So I had to. So I was like filming 5 months and then editing it. So I was really lucky about it, and that's why I chose it, because I know there's the starting point and the end point, and there's no way.
True. It's true.
It's very important for you aspiring documentary makers and the audience to know where your film ends before
yeah,
it begins.
That's right. True.
If only the rest of the Middle East were so simple.
Kurt, how did you, in approaching a controversial subject like this, what is your background in kind of developing journalistic skills?
Nothing. Actually, nothing. I worked in PR in New York, and I did entertainment PR, so I learned how to be a professional whore to sell my film. That was about it. But I just kind of fell into it, and like this subject was just interesting. And luckily, this was when we were able to shoot it, from beginning of shooting to the first rough cut, just under 5 months. And I think I have to thank PETA for that, because they originally agreed to be in the film, then they pulled out, and then suddenly all the largest animal rights organizations in the country were putting out websites, beware of filmmaker Kurt Johnson. So I was busting my ass to like get every interview I could. So PETA helped make the film move very fast. So thank you, PETA.
And how have the people who are in the film been reacting to the film? Have they had chances to screen it yet?
Well, what's been kind of cool, it showed us the film is objective, because I've had people on the left, or conservatives and liberals, the same complaint. The only complaint they've had is you let the other side talk too much, or you let them look good. And our whole point was I wanted everyone lit well, and if they flubbed a line, they repeated it, because I wasn't going to do those tricks. So that's been the only complaint. So it was like, thank God we were objective, you know?
That happens. People hated that we humanized Conrad Black. I can't tell you how many letters we got saying, how dare you? I have a very different background, it sounds like, from the rest of you. I've been pretty much a lifelong journalist, and I started as a print reporter, and I've done a lot of freelance writing over the years, everything from the St. Petersburg Times to the Guardian in London, and I worked for about 8 years in Los Angeles for Associated Press TV News, which is one of the big wire feed services. So pretty much everything we do, including all of our documentaries, are kind of grown out of that soil.
What happens with your films when they're done? Ricky, in the case of Trials of Daryl Hunt, I believe that you did a lot of work just getting that film out into the world, and I think you're planning to do the same this time. Can you talk about how the films continue on in the world?
Well, the Trials of Daryl Hunt, as I said, we shot over 10 years, and we didn't have an end, and he was finally, after 20 years, exonerated, and that became our end. But the journey of getting money was its own thing. So when we finally finished it, we sold it to HBO. And that sounds great, but it was a long battle to obviously get there. And then that one's going to come out at the same time that The Devil Came on Horseback, because we made Devil Came on Horseback in a year, because of the subject matter, had to get out very quickly, and so we're sort of releasing them at the same time. And The Devil Came on Horseback, as Jane can attest, premiered at Sundance, and it was like all these people, and it was all this buzz, and everyone had to see it, and all the people, it had to go up the ranks, and I just had this feeling, like, okay, and let's get a deal. And I think because it's political, in the sense that, not that it's anti-American by any means, but it just points out what the lack of movement in the government and in the UN and the Security Council, and its genocide. It's been having a difficult time sort of getting the distribution, but what we will do is we will probably open it theatrically on our own. It will have a TV deal. I can't say who, because we haven't signed papers, and we'll have a DVD. Did I say TV? TV and DVD. We'll have all those things, but we have decided just to try to push through and raise money to take it out theatrically on our own so that we can just get it going.
Ailette, how do your films make it out into the world, and how much do you participate in that process and talking to audiences? And
well, my films, most of my films are just shown in Israel because they're very, inside matters. And
local, nothing wrong with local.
No, it's okay. That's how
Omar's
I do.
Yeah. Interest is all local.
Yeah. And so I do a lot of talkings. I do a lot of appearing, and this film is just going around without me. I'm not part of it. But I want to tell you that part of the money for this film got from the second channel. And they had to screen it. It was like something they had to do. So it was not announced in the newspaper, and they had no promo. It was just screened, we didn't know, just one day before. It was, and, well, so maybe abroad I can get more audience to see it.
Kurt, how about with your films? In the case of Your Mommy Kills Animals, do you foresee this film being part of a kind of a larger conversation around animal rights? Is that something you want to be taking part in?
It's kind of like just putting a face on the movement, you know, because again, like everyone has their perceptions of when you say animal rights activists, they think one thing, and it kind of like the film breaks it down so you see those actual people like animal welfare, which are most people who like, you know, there should be no cruelty. Yeah, it's just wrong to be like, you know, willfully being cruel to animals, and then animal rights and then animal liberation, which are the more militant. But it kind of like, luckily, I think after all doing all the sneak peeks we've done in America, it raised enough where the distributors finally took attention, because, you know, film, it was like we finished all the edits in July, and all the distributors were just kind of like, so what do you want the audience to think? And it's frustrating because you're like that, you know, because they're used to tell, you know, they want audiences, we're supposed to tell them what to think, and it's frustrating when it's like, well, can't we let them think for themselves? And they get that glazed look at you like, oh yeah, you know. So literally it was like a last ditch effort last December. I went to, you know, let the animal groups know, like, listen, if you want to, like, you know, screen the film, you know, you set it all up, you keep the ticket sales, and I got a free test screenings in 8 cities, and that got the distributor's attention, because we were, like, getting $5,000 per screen. And, of course, that's when you get the distributor's attention, when you're like, oh, there's money. And as long as they know they're going to make money, at least it gets it out there. And it also raises awareness on the Shaq 7 case, because, like, some of the tactics they've used, you know, I don't agree with all the tactics of, like, firebombing.
Maybe you should just elaborate on what the Shaq 7 case is.
The Shaq 7, it's a group of activists that we follow in the film, and the U.S. government, in a landmark case, put them on trial for their website. And it was mainly for the website, saying, your website can provoke people to do violence. And it's a little scary because, you know, we were assuming, oh, they're going to be acquitted.
But the NRA website is fine.
Yeah, and it's and what was weird is doing that, you know, when I looked into, because I assumed that the abortion people, the pro-abortion, or the anti-abortion people, I figured they must be on the terrorist list because it's the same tactics, and they're not. And that's what kind of made, you know, I just thought this should definitely be raised because the media in America barely covered this trial. Mm-hmm. And after the Shaq 7 sentencing, and it was weird because they were sentenced the day after the 5th anniversary of 9/11 for domestic terrorism. So, and I don't think that was a coincidence. And I sent out a release, and I was just curious about to see, like, whose release would get picked up by the press. And there was a pharmaceutical company that had put one out, and that was what all the press, of course, they ran that one. But oddly enough, like, the New York Times and the New York Post, they called, they wanted to see the film, and suddenly now they're curious to watch the appeal process. So it was like, oh, thank God, if the film could kind of help the press be like, you know, it's not just a one-sided trial, you should look a little bit further. And hopefully if that helps raise that awareness so people realize, like, you know, this is a little scary because now, because of the conviction in the United States, if you have a website that could, they feel can provoke violence, you are forced to take it down. I mean, and that's the scariest thing, so.
Rick, what is the future of your film at this point?
We've had a very mixed reaction in the United States. Even when people turn it down, the distributors, they always say things like, there's much to recommend, but I wouldn't be caught dead distributing this film because of what you have to say in the film itself. At least they're upfront about it, so we thought that was kind of refreshing. So, but there is some kind of lower level interest with the so-called smaller distribs, and they're kind of nibbling at the fringes right now, and we have a guy in the United States who's sort of advising us, and that's all being kind of run through him. So, but like Ricky, we don't have anything signed yet, so I'm loath to discuss details.
Yeah, I mean, I was just gonna say, for filmmakers, and we're learning this every day and every year, it's something different, that now it seems like there just isn't money out there. The docs are just not making the money back that's being put in for P&A to get docs out there. So
in a theatrical setting.
In a theatrical.
Specifically, because I think at the DVD level, some of these films
DVD,
are doing very well.
But in terms of theatrical, it's really dying out now, this theatrical interest. And then television cable, while there's television cable, it's not enough money to make back, you know, nearly even a quarter of your budget that it takes to make a doc. So then if you're lucky, you have a subject like Darfur, which has an international appeal, you know, and probably, but if you don't, you're really stuck in the United States and maybe Canada, and you're stuck with, you know, your one either cable or TV deal. It's just not a lot of money.
It's quite very big, hard. You know, Israel is a very small country, so if you're stuck with the local.
It's even worse for you.
Yeah. Now, when you were saying, like, do you mean, like, when it's the prints, like, 35 millimeter, blowing up to 35 millimeter?
No, I'm just saying
in general?
Getting it into the theaters to sell it, even, you know, to get a distributor to pick it up now. There's just not that much money being made with theatrical releases unless there's a couple that hit big. And I think in the past year they're going, oh, you know what, we're not going to take out docs anymore because they're just not making the money back for P&A, for print and advertising.
Yeah, see, and I just figured, like, because it almost seems like now they're doing, like, theatrical is more of a platform because, you know, the DVD comes really quick.
Well,
it's more like a
platform. They do this very vanity kind of, but it's... Yeah, you get your reviews in the theater.
We're definitely not going to get on 1,000 screens, that's for sure.
You know? And then you get your theater reviews and it drives your DVD sales. Yeah,
that's about it. Let's make this conversation a little bit more interactive if there are people in the audience who have questions. Yes, in the back there. Oh, you know, we have a mic over here. Well, let me wait until the microphone comes around.
Why do you think the distributors are so hesitant to promote or take political documentaries?
Well, our film actually in general asks the question, when did politics become a dirty word? I don't see Rudy Butenal here, but he's one of the guys that took a look at the rough cut. He was convinced when he saw the rough cut of our film, the answer to that is when celebrities got involved. I think that's part of it, but I actually think it's much larger than that, which is, in the United States specifically, politics became a dirty word when the political organizations themselves stopped giving a crap what the people think about and they just want to win. So that's kind of muddied the soil for all of us. And you see tactics being used by both parties that are quite heavy-handed and they feel there's grievances from the past and we've stopped listening to the other side totally. What comes to mind is I was shooting a sequence in 2004 in the very area in Jacksonville, Florida, where they had a lot of problems in the 2000 election, and a Republican was screaming at a Democrat, you're the party that stole Chicago in 1960 for Kennedy, and the Democrat was screaming back, and you're the party of Strom Thurmond and Trent Lott, and he went through the laundry list of all the Republicans that had been in Trent Lott is back in power now, by the way. But anyhow, so when the two sides stop listening to each other, and the parties don't really care other than they want to win and hold all the cards, politically speaking. And so that there may be something to that. Now, the distributors specifically, they're just absolutely petrified of political films. Why would a distributor want to sell his hard-earned reputation down the river for our one little movie? Forget about it. There's no... And since our film politically cuts kind of a little weird, even for us, the filmmakers, I have to say that, their lack of imagination prevents them from seeing an audience for the film. We see it because every time we show it, it sells out, but the distributors aren't there. And on the odd occasion when they are there, they discount the festival audiences anyhow because they're like, it's not you guys I'm after. I'm after, you're the aficionados and you're into it. You know, I'm on a much wider audience than that for this film where I'm not interested. And maybe part of the problem here is if you're looking at a P&A campaign that starts on the low end at say $5 million, where's the upside for them to be showing our little movies that are like $300,000, $400,000 films? You know, they feel like, yeah, you've taken a risk, but I got to take a much greater risk than you ever did.
There, even if it's $300,000 for P&A, which is what you're going to get for a doc campaign, not $5 million. I mean, they have to make that back.
So that model is changing then, and that's why you'll have someone like Michael Moore making a Fahrenheit 9/11 that had a going-in budget of $6 million. I presume Sicko has a larger budget, although you may know more about that than I do, so...
I also think, though, it makes us, like, be a little more creative, though. I mean, because I know, like, we're always like, oh, the distributors, you know. And I see it from their end because it's like, you know, they're seeing film after film after film. And after a while, it's like, how do you sell the film? And a lot of times they don't see it like we see it, and we know, like, our audience. Because, like, for this Your Mommy, I mean, you know, in Toronto, you see the six-foot bunny. That's our marketing, you know. And it's actually raising awareness. And we're also doing a music video. I've got this amazing guy who's doing a music video for the film, and I'm showing the distributor in America, it's like, this is how we can do it without all these print ads and TV ads, because Grindhouse, you know, they did TV, print, forgot the internet, and you saw what happened, and it's kind of like focusing on, there's cheap ways to do it, but I think sometimes it makes us be a little more creative so we can show the distributor there is an audience, and we kind of make our audience, if that makes sense.
I was going to, when you asked me political, the one thing is you can tap into, which we're doing with the Darfur film, the Save Darfur, Move On, the different organizations that have growing website appeal and can advertise for free, essentially. Also companies like Starbucks. There are different companies out there that now are trying to get more political, or I don't know, we may be too controversial, but you know, they're getting behind green films or whatever they're behind. And so Africa and
so they're comfortable when it's a company if it's political up to a point.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I'm not sure. I know they're into Africa, but I don't know if they'll but it has turned us, everyone, I'm sure out there too, into distributors or into like creative thinking and thinking outside the box, and it's just not going to be a standard release, and you're just going to have to figure out where your audience is and then move beyond that audience.
I think another aspect of the phenomena that you describe of perhaps political parties being out of touch with their constituents is that I think we've seen the last few years, you know, certain documentaries hitting those constituents directly through DVD campaigns, and you know, some documentaries aren't even that good a documentary.
And I think it works on more than one level, right? A lot of our films, we exist in that little pocket that the mainstream media has created by not covering the very topics that are in our films. For instance, I mean, for better or for worse, we needed a film like Fahrenheit 9/11 when it came out to open that debate. You don't have to agree with everything in that film necessarily, but the fact that he did it when he did it to open that political debate was crucially important, I felt. The fact that he would go up in the Oscars stage in the when he was winning his award, and he's willing to make that anti-Bush, anti-war speech when 80% of the American public were behind that war, and that's why you heard him so roundly booed when he did that. It was a bold and audacious maneuver, and it forces a debate on people who wouldn't otherwise even discuss these issues. I watched the Oscars this last year. I was so bored. Nobody had any. It's like the war isn't even going on anymore. Yeah. It's like.
Okay, other questions? Yeah, right here. You.
Thanks. I'm a journalist in Toronto, and print journalist. And I guess my question is mostly directed towards you, Kurt. I mean, to me, I'm thinking about making a film now that I've stopped writing for a major paper here. And objective was always the thing that we absolutely had to be. You have to show two sides. And I mean, you may have to have two sides, but surely you have an agenda. You've got to have an agenda. You have to have some passion for something.
This notion you're raising about objectivity versus subjectivity, I find endlessly fascinating, because it's something that all documentarists have to struggle with and answer these kinds of charges all the time. Look, my take on it, and Kurt, I'm sure, is going to have his own thing to say, and I know you haven't even addressed this to me, by the way, but let me just get this off my chest real quick. For when people approach me and say, well, there is no true objectivity, so then this is sort of this other thing we're doing anyhow, I get that argument, because everything is, even by the selection of your subject and your interviews and how you handle it, it's all completely subjective. And then, of course, how you choose to handle that material coming out of that, it's all completely subjective. But what rankles me is when someone says, well, because there is no true objectivity, therefore I can just throw the baby out with the bathwater. Now, anything goes in my film because it's nothing but subjective anyhow. But then there goes the standards of decency, fairness, balance, consideration, care for your subject, all those other things that I think most ethical documentarists deal with on a daily basis, and they're quite concerned about it, not just, how can I quickly do this thing and dispose them like a tissue or something, you know, that's not really what's going on. Right.
Really manipulative, I mean, and was not upfront with his subjects, and therefore he's the classic example of somebody who had too much of an agenda and lost credibility. And that's not what I'm saying, but I mean, like, you know, your engagement, you said you knew nothing about animal rights and that they're terrorists and stuff. I don't know much about them either, but you know, you must engage. I mean, didn't you have an idea, a vision of how you wanted your film? I mean, this is open to anybody.
Yeah, actually, it's one of those weird ones, because I know, like, when people, like, especially if I ever talk to finance people, you know, they're like, so what's your film going to be about? Well, it's like, well, I'm just thinking, I kind of want to look at this subject. And of course, and it's like, that's it. And because I had no idea, like I went in just thinking, okay, it's kind of cool. We get to do, we'll have a lot, be able to be outside a lot and just kind of take a look at the whole animal rights movement. I mean, literally that, I mean, it sounds really naive, but I guess that's my, luckily I guess not going to school for it. I just kind of go in like, okay. I mean, I started out, like I went to the ALF website, or for anyone, Animal Liberation Front website. I mean, literally I just emailed like, hey, I'm doing a documentary. I want to talk to some people. I mean, literally that was it. And it worked. You know, and it actually, we started getting responses. And it wasn't until I think our last interview, we were driving back from Omaha, Nebraska, and I like look at my cameraman, I'm just like, I had no clue we were doing a film on freedom of speech and domestic terrorism. Because it was just, you know, I was intrigued just the fact that this group is number one, and since I'm not an animal rights activist, it was kind of like, it was easier for me. And to me, I always assume like, if I don't know something, most people probably aren't aware of it either. And usually, then luckily, I've been lucky with the films I get. But, and so I didn't have an idea. I just wanted to, you know, originally, I think if PETA hadn't pulled out, it would have been a different film. It would have been kind of boring. It would have just been like, here's the animal rights movement. And because when PETA pulled out, suddenly like they had everyone from, you know, people like Charlize Theron, Priscilla Presley, Rue McClanahan telling people in Hollywood, don't talk to this guy. And they ended up, suddenly everyone in Hollywood knew about my film. And it was like, thank you, that's so cool. You know, but, and what happened was then suddenly it was like more people started coming out. And I started learning, you know, like, oh, I didn't know that about PETA. Because there's some things in there, you know, and some people have said, well, you seem really critical. And I guess if I had an agenda, you know, for like pro-animal rights, the PETA section, since they pulled out, you know, I can't balance it. I can't, you know, I didn't want to put my opinion in like, well, they've done some good. You know, because they didn't talk. So hopefully that answers the question. You know, I really just, you know, like the film I'm doing now is called Pets on Your Plate, about the whole food rendering. I just got kind of intrigued because this guy has like an Aaron Brockovich story, and I'm like, oh, I didn't know that. And it, once again, I'm like, if I didn't know it, I'm sure a lot of other people don't. So I'm doing the same thing now with this film. So.
And you may find when you make your own docs that sometimes that journey that you're able to go on, whether you have an agenda or not, by the way, that journey
totally
can be equally or even sometimes more revealing than what the final destination is, something you're typically going to find in print, especially when you're a reporter who's anxious to keep yourself out of the article.
I mean, because haven't you had stories like when you would like, let me just look into that, and totally changed everything for you, and you had no clue what it would do. It's the same exact thing. Like this, yeah, so.
All right, this woman in the purple right here. Microphone.
I'm just a little curious about the process and how maybe you make that political, because I haven't seen any of your films, but I have seen a couple of films in the past few years, and I kind of walk away thinking, well, maybe this made a certain kind of political statement, but you feel as though maybe the filmmakers have also taken something from the people that they've been interviewing, and they're telling a very personal story, or it's, you know, emotional in that way. And I wonder, you know, what happens after? What happens when you come back and you have this film and you're distributing it, and what about the people that it's about?
Very, very good question. Anyone want to?
Yeah, I'm telling. Yeah, for me, it's really strong because the only way I could enter Gaza was because I had a press card, and it's very complicated in Israel to get a press card because it's a governmental thing. So filmmakers don't get press cards. So now I can't go in Gaza anymore, and well. For me, it was a very strong experience being in Gaza and meeting the people that, you know, I live in Tel Aviv and Gaza is just 1 hour away. I mean, it's, and nobody knows anything about life there and people there, and like they think it's a very dangerous place, and I met really beautiful people and loving people, and I was welcomed there. And so I got a strong thing about hope, about those people that they work in the fields, and there are bombs all over, and they keep on laughing and making jokes, and really, I mean, you know, in Israel, if there will be a bomb, everybody will be in a shelter. I mean, and they live like that all the time. And for 2 years in a row, the strawberries got stuck in Gaza, and they found themselves, I don't know, in the dumpster or something. And everybody thought they're not going to make a third year of strawberries. And sure enough, June came, and they were planting again. I mean, it was really strong for me to have this power of life, want to live and want to make a little bit of money and, you know, hope for the, like I say, make it possible in the impossible. I mean, finding a way to make it possible in the impossible. And now it's really strong because I cannot really see those people anymore. And it's really sad.
I'll just also add about Strawberry Fields. We've been talking about the kind of political dimension from the point of view of Israeli-Palestinian politics. There's also another layer to it, which is just about the planting of food, an aspect of our daily life that we take for granted, people who make our food, that I found very moving in the film. Ricky, this question about what happens to the people who are in the films, maybe the case of Daryl Hunt, the man who you filmed, who'd been wrongfully in prison for so many years, and then you filmed several of his times of going before the parole board, each time when you thought that he was probably going to get off, and over a period of, I think, over 10 years, that didn't happen, and then finally he did. Now that film has been out in the world for a year or so, what's been the experience for both Daryl Hunt and some of the other people who are in the film, the lawyers, the prosecutors, etc.?
Well, I was just going to say, I feel sorry for my friends and my family because, you know, every film you do, it is a passionate thing because, you know, it's so hard to get the money and you immerse yourself in the story and in the politics of what the story is. And then I have to, like, talk endlessly at dinner parties or whatever about, like, and so then we should really do this and the government, you know, and you just get very political about whatever subject it is because it's so important to you and you're around with people who are, you know, who devote their lives to it, so their energy is infectious, and you're just, you know, you want to deliver their message and make sure you do a good job of it. But Daryl, in particular, you know, is this incredible human being and has gone on to start his own foundation to help others who have been wrongly convicted and to help them with reentry. And, you know, we are extremely passionate about him, and, you know, and he's become a good friend, and we help him in any way we can. And I think, you know, through the years, I made a film about a boxing gym in the South Bronx, like in 1992, I think. And I mean, these guys, Joey and Angel, came to my screening at HBO of this other movie, and they were like, oh, so these are your new boyfriends, you know, like, we moved on, we'd sort of spurned them and the same thing was said of, you know, of Brian and this other subject, and I think you do, I don't know, it just is, I think why I love doing it is because I have this relationship with these people that lasts a lifetime, and whatever they're going through, I take on as, you know, does make you political about whatever it is, I think. It's hard to avoid it.
Let's see, this gentleman right here.
It sounds like Kirk and Rick, you've been declared an enemy by your subject. And I'm wondering if you could elaborate on that, at least in the last film. How does that happen? Can it be prevented? And sometimes does it work the other way, that you're as loved as...
Well, I'm not loved by all in my films, but I can tell you stories.
Well, we believe in fraternizing with the enemy, such as it were. And for me, that's a really strong term because that's, we kind of came to this from a place of love and worship, really. I don't know how else to describe it other than to say that. But yeah, things turned, and like Kurt said, in terms of his film, probably had Michael opened his doors to us a little more, our film would be a very different movie than it is. We're very upfront about that. Our hope always was that he would be the narrator of our movie. It didn't work out that way, and we chose to follow the bouncing ball and take the film a different direction. I guess coming from a journalist background, it was something quite easy for me to recognize because I'm at editorial meetings at a newspaper at 9 a.m., and the editor sends me out to cover a story that day, but then there I am on the cell phone at 1:30 saying, you know, the thing that we talked about this morning, well, it's not quite exactly that. It's this other thing, which I actually think we should be telling this other story instead. And by the way, the smarter editors will say, great, let's go for that, as opposed to, well, let's have another editorial meeting again tomorrow and make you tell the story that we're trying to get you to tell all along. That's what the dumb editors do. And I, by the way, I've been down both paths in the course of my life. So for us, that felt kind of, in a certain sense, kind of natural to steer it a different direction. Again, enemy is a very strong term. I'm not one anxious to kick Michael Moore out of the documentary camp, I can tell you that.
Oh, I think for us, it was like our film, we came out like we were the thorn in the side for him, because when he came back from Cannes with the Palme d'Or, literally the front page of Variety was his story, and right next to his story was my story. You know, like I came on as a producer of the film of Michael Moore Hates America, so suddenly the press were hounding him. And it's in the film too, where the Hollywood Reporter, I think he had just been like really, he was just pissed from hearing Michael Moore Hates America so much. He kind of went off on the Hollywood Reporter, was like, they're frauds, they're phonies, and it was like, oh dude, that's not good. So that was the only thing, but that was the only enemy thing. But I think most people who haven't seen the film, they just assume from the title, they've labeled me a conservative, and I'm definitely a Democrat. So that's been the only enemy. And like I said, I think I'll be 60 and I'll still hear neocon. And I actually did, I never heard that before, and I was like, what the hell's a neocon? So.
Well, also, it's usually the people who don't grant you interviews. In our case, it's police or district attorneys or whomever it is. They, you know, maybe, they may dislike our story, but I, you know, you always give them an opportunity to speak. So it's usually people who don't give you the interview, like Michael Moore or whoever, who don't like the story you've told, but had they spoken.
It would have been different.
Yeah, their voice would have been in it, so.
Well, right here, while we've got the microphone, I'll get you, sir, next.
I think I've got two sort of more practical questions than philosophical. For the moderator, there are documentaries you know before Hot Doc starts that are going to be more in demand than others, but it doesn't seem like you get additional screenings for something like Manufacturing Dissent, and maybe it's the ultimate in democratization that nobody gets more screenings or whatever. And the second question to the filmmakers is there any way for the public to influence the ability to get things seen? Like, I know I sent an email last week to TV Ontario to find out whether they'd have Manufacturing Dissent on, and because they had the Citizen Black on, I got a rather, what I thought was a formulaic response from customer relations saying, it's not currently part of our inventory, we'll send it along to the program director, but since Rudy Bodignol, or however, you know, has got an award at this festival, I assume he's a fan, but can the public influence these getting, I assume there's no hope on the theater side of things, but, you know, things like the CBC, you know, News World, you know, TV Ontario, does a public campaign help, or, you know, on something like that?
I was going to say, we've gotten, yes, I mean, for us, it has helped us. We've gotten a lot of emails from showing at festivals, and we've actually forwarded those emails sometimes to distributors. We've, like, pasted them all on one big fat email saying, look at all these people that want to see this movie. We always collect their emails, and we put them on a big list. We've got thousands of people now from our other film and growing for the new film, and we let them know when the film's going to become available. But I don't know how much it helps, but it certainly makes the filmmaker feel better that their movie is wanted, you know. So, but we have tried to leverage it. I mean, we got the numbers from all these Darfur organizations and organizations that have been invested in it, like Jewish organizations, and we ran those numbers to like 6 million, and we gave it to all of our potential buyers, and, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, even if there is potentially this demand, if they don't want to get behind it for all their scared reasons. But we did actually send those emails to people saying, see, they really want to see this movie.
And to quickly answer your question about programming at film festivals, normally and I don't program for this festival, but when I program for the Toronto Film Festival, we keep a limited number of screenings because we want these films to go on to have other public venues, and we don't want to kill all the audience in a festival setting. I think this gentleman here has been very patiently raising his hand.
I've been making political documentaries one way or another for about 35 years in various sort of forms, and I have this theory that I want to run by you, which is actually fairly depressing about the political influence of these documentaries that we're making today, and all four of these documentaries sound absolutely great. And it's this. When there were less documentary festivals and less of an independent documentary industry, there was network coverage of major acts of international injustice. And, you know, it could be argued that in the 70s and 80s, working at the Journal at CBC and Fifth Estate, we really went after apartheid. You know, we saw the fall of the Berlin Wall. You know, we went after the death squads in Central America. And there was a real sense, there was a real dynamic, there was a real sense of these things were changing, and the more we hammered away at them, they seemed to sort of fall before our eyes, and the public, you know, the tipping point happened, the public got behind these issues. Today, we have almost a complete collapse of serious investigative foreign journalism on network television. And we have all these fabulous documentaries being made by independent documentary producers. And the feeling I get is that, in a sense, the Iraq war is not being stopped by all of these great independent documentaries. And that the other side, if you will, the forces that, you know, can go to war in a place like Iraq, actually benefit from this conversation between great, talented, creative documentary makers and the chattering classes. So I it's a rather depressing kind of conclusion, I guess, this idea is I actually think even though...
Well, you're right insofar as the dialogue and debate that we're hoping to spur with all of our... It should be happening on the major networks, for instance. Of course, they don't have the power now that they used to have either, right? But you're right, and to a certain degree, the corporations who run the media companies, largely in the United States and Canada, have figured out ways to outsource this difficult and dangerous work. And so we've taken up the cause, and I'm sure any of us could tell you at great cost to ourselves. This is not, you know, you're not being paid the staff salary being a correspondent on 60 Minutes when you work on a film for 15 years about this wrongly convicted person, for instance. So look, they want ever increasing quarterly profits, so they've kind of done what they felt a need to do, and what they've done is close their foreign bureaus and drop this kind of reporting because it's very expensive, very time consuming, and occasionally will turn on some of the very corporations that support these media outlets, and they don't like that one bit at all. So you've raised a very interesting question. Where do we go from here, I guess, is what I'm wondering. Do you know?
I think it's also a glasses half full or half empty question, because if we think of the Vietnam War as a war that, you know, was the first war, as it said, that entered people's homes through television, and we think about the television coverage of it changing in some way, led entirely by much more by the network news coverage than by independent documentarians. Yet still, I mean, the Vietnam War, major escalation of that war started around 1965. The war wound down 9 years later. We've had quite a lot of independent coverage of Iraq, and in fact, independent documentarians coming out with films on Iraq much more quickly than happened in Vietnam. So I wonder if sometimes there isn't a kind of romantic sense about what happened in the past versus now. I think that they were probably both difficult situations to change public opinion.
But also to add to the depressing note, I think the demand, I mean, look at the demand. People really, I spoke to someone at a cable station right after Iraq, and she was like, oh my God, if I hear of another pitch about Baghdad, you know, I think that there's this sense of like, oh, there's so many films about Iraq, you know, and no one wants to go see them. No one wants to hear about it. And I'm generalizing because, of course, that's not true. But I just really wonder, you know, what people are tuning on television and going to see movies and paying money, the American public, for the most part, I don't think they're asking people to make movies that are political and that are, I mean, or turning on television shows that are political. They really want to numb out at the end of a day, and they want a date night movie. And it's very, people know this in distribution. It's hard to, you know, they want a romantic comedy. They sell, you know, blockbuster movies sell, shoot 'em up movies sell. And you know, if you look at it too, what's happened in Hollywood and just sort of this like Hollywood obsession with celebrity, and there's there's every newspaper out there, every magazine now between Hello and OK and Us and whatever they are. I mean, when did all those come out? And they get bought every day. I mean, the mass market consumption of celebrity is just phenomenal. We should do a documentary about it because it will sell.
Entertaining ourselves to death. There you go.
What? Okay.
I'm in.
This woman right here.
I just want to actually add a small optimistic thing. I'm director of another film festival in San Francisco, actually, at Stanford University. It's called United Nations Association Film Festival. And we do have a collaboration with a lot of TV stations. One of them is HBO. So they do present a very powerful, very provocative, very political films. So there is a hope. And then after that, we actually received a lot of letters and emails from our audience members to give support to this kind of programs. So that's, I think it's up to us, to the audience also, and the programmers to collaborate.
Don't you think that the rise of film festivals has given a significant alternative venue to taking in ideas and being a wonderful kind of tide pool that can begin the growth of these documentaries out into a wider marketplace? And festivals like Hot Docs and some of the other documentary festivals that have sprung up just in the last 10 years or so, that's a very recent phenomenon in the grand scheme of our media.
It is all helpful and optimistic, so we're grateful in that.
So I'm afraid, sir, you've encountered a panel of optimists. right here, and then I'll get down here.
Instant conversion.
Thanks. I was curious if you guys wanted to elaborate more on why you think there is a decline in public appetite for political issues, or why, or where the political culture has gone.
Well, Ricky talked about it briefly. I mean, look, if you dig ditches for a living, man, when you're done at the end of the day and you sit on your sofa at 9 o'clock at night, you don't want to wade through one of our heavy matter films. You'd much rather watch reality TV, especially if it has a convenient scripted ending or whatever. It's just mentally, it's a whole lot less grueling than the kind of stuff that we're producing.
Yeah, who wants to see the problems of the world?
Yeah,
it's like when you're making them, it's like it's depressing. I mean, there are times like when there was a point during the trial of these Shaq kids, I was with the crew, I was like, I just want to go to a mall. I just want to do something mainstream. I mean, I want something mainstream America because it's really...
Dunkin' Donuts.
No, really, because when you see it, and so I
but
understand...
The point is, like, we're not immune from this impulse either. Because we're the people digging the ditches till 9 o'clock at night.
I cannot tell you how many times people have said, my documentary's on tonight, and we're like, I just cannot see another documentary.
There's a question down here.
I wanted to ask Ricky, do you have a wrestling match with yourself when you're putting the film together? I don't know if the clip was representative of the rest of the film. But is there a conflict between sort of aestheticizing disaster and pacing the film in a way that appeals to the younger audience that you want, that's probably accustomed to, you know, music video type editing, versus taking the subject matter seriously?
This is the opening, so it is very fast moving and there's a lot of music. But frankly, I think if you don't make the movie entertaining, no one wants to see it. And so our movies are entertaining about deep, dark subjects. And I say to people, like, go see the movie. It may be hard, but it's entertaining. I know genocide is hard to say, but the story, I think that's why you try to get your character. Our character himself has this fascinating story of being a military kid who witnessed this, and you see his transformation. It's a journey through him becoming sort of an activist in some ways, although he doesn't call himself an activist, but speaking out. So I do think you have a responsibility, yes. But you know what? I always watch the movie, and if it's boring, we cut it out. Because if I find it boring and I'm vested in it, someone else is really going to find it boring. So I think it's, you know, if you are respectful of your subject matter and the people and the story you're telling, it's not that complicated. I don't think we ever, I rarely have gotten into a situation where I go, is this exploitive? In the other case of the other film, I have the crime scene photographs of this victim, and they are in color, and we use them in the film because it's important to see how the district attorney used them and laid them out in front of the... But we decided to turn them in black and white because I put on my mother, you know, I'm a mother, I put on my mommy hat for a minute, and I said, you know what, I would never want to see my daughter or have my daughter exposed in such vivid... It would kill me. And so I was thinking about the victim's mother, who I never met and who never granted us an interview because she thought this man was actually the murderer. And we just made them black and white, and we never showed her face. We just showed, you know, anyway. But yes, I think you have to be, but you also have to make a movie that is not just a talking head these days, because we're beyond that.
Yeah, can I add to that? Because originally when we were in edit, I was trying to use, like, no music. Because I was like, you know, in movies it's always music, music, music. And it was so damn long. song. So it was like, had to add Pantera. Because it's like, you know, like you said, it's like, in a theater, like, you know, we're trying to make these for a mainstream because we don't want to, like, preach to the choir. You want it for a mainstream audience. And you have to, you know, when people are like, oh, are you a journalist? I'm like, no, I'm just an infotainer. You know, because that's basically what it is we're getting the facts in, but we got to entertain. You know, otherwise people aren't, you know, like the gentleman up there said, people aren't going to see it. You keep the integrity of the film, but you know how to make it so people will want to come see it. You know, again, like in this one, we have a lot of humor because most people are expecting this to be this gore fest and just really depressing. It's like, no, you got to balance it, you know, and sure, like just in yours.
It's what they've long said about satire, too, right? If you look at the articles that are in, say, Frank Magazine versus a article that you could read in the Globe and Mail, what the satirist has to do is even more difficult. You still have to tell that story somehow that the audience is with it and then figure out a way to spin it out funny or entertaining or amusing. So it's kind of one step up from just straight reporting, which is adds another layer of difficulty, especially when you're dealing with matters that are not inherently funny, like...
Yeah, you know,
like all of our films, come to think of it.
I usually use a lot of music in my films, but in this film I couldn't find any music that will fit the film, and it's the first film I did without music, right. And I don't think it's boring.
Well, not that Beatles song?
No, but I get the name.
But one thing that struck me about the clip that we just saw here is that even though there's shooting going on, there's something that's almost comic about that moment that that he's having this conversation about planting strawberries and then very kind of casually like ducking down for a bullet and then continuing
but
the conversation.
But it's his character. Then later on you meet him again and there's a shot and he jumps again, you know, he's
okay, we have just a few minutes left. Maybe we can fit in one more question. Are you scratching yourself or do you have a question? Okay.
Hi. I watch a lot of political films, and I feel like a distinction can be made in the political films that I see between films that are just about political subjects and leave me feeling like I just watched a film that's telling me that bad things are happening in the world, and then films which actually seek to explore or understand some of the dynamics that are at play in that political situation. And I find that the former is much more ubiquitous than the latter. And those films I find really frustrating and often very boring. And yet, when I watch them, I wonder if it's just what that's about, if it's a lack of willingness to engage with some of the issues, a sense that the issues are too complex, or low expectations of the actual audience members. So I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about how much you felt like you could expect from your audience when you were dealing with your subjects.
Every filmmaker has their own take. We like to think that we don't talk down to our audience when we make a movie for them. We want, like Kurtz, we would like the audience to make up their own mind a bit out of what we're trying to present, as opposed to us saying from up on high, this is what you ought to think, feel, and believe about this. And so some audiences are frustrated by that, particularly the ones that like being told what to think and feel about something. And so we hear comments like there's not such a conclusion. Well, from our point of view, it's an ongoing story, and we've tried to open this dialogue and debate, so we're not anxious to kind of close any doors that way. But some filmmakers feel no compunction about treating the audience differently and talking down to them, making them think, using a great deal of heavy-handed manipulation to make you think, feel, and believe certain things about what they're presenting. From my point of view, the usual telltale sign is, and this is exactly what our film has done, by the way, in this particular instance, is that the overall approach is quite heavy-handed, that it has a voiceover narration, that it has, the filmmaker may or may not be a character in the movie, but on more than one level, they're trying to tell you how you think you should feel about these things that are unfolding on camera. So, but our, and we've, my partner and I have made, I guess this is our fifth film together, and three of them have been observational docs where we're never on camera. It doesn't really have anything to do about us. It's the subjects who are in the film. But we felt we needed to go a different direction with this one because of the things that we're developing on the ground that we weren't capturing. And we started to feel guilty about not capturing that. And it could be something we could do something with down the road.
Well, the conflict in Darfur can be very, very complicated and long in the history of the conflict in Africa. So we really had to work to simplify it. And because our audience is a general audience, I think you have to know who your audience is. If we were going to scholars on Africa, we would fail because we have a very simplified version of the conflict. But for the general audience out there who doesn't really know that much about Darfur, you know, you just give them the bullet points, and then hopefully that inspires them to learn more about what's going on. So you just, I think, primarily know your audience and then work from there.
I think it's wrong to think of any film as being the last word on a subject or even the only words. And I think one of the very healthy things about the documentary culture today is that we have more than one film coming out. Well, we have five films on Michael Moore alone. We have many films on the Middle East, and hopefully we're going to see many more films on Darfur.
But there's only one good one.
Michael Moore hates America.
Devil Came on Horseback, unfortunately, is screening right this minute for its last screen, but I'm sure that film will be making its way to Canadian television and hopefully theaters and DVD and other venues. Strawberry Fields screens tonight at 7. Yeah. From Strawberry Fields, you can go see Manufacturing Descent, which screens at 9 o'clock tonight. Yeah. And tomorrow night, Your Mommy Kills Animals. Thank you very much for coming on this beautiful day. Thank you to our panelists.